Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chats, fortnightly podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent. Hello, Will.
Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will. And today we've got Kez Knight with us, who's a longtime contributor to Django, member of the Django Triage and Review team, and, you know, general member of the community. Hello, Kez. Thanks for coming on.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
No, it's a real honour. Wanted to have you on for a while. Let's start. We always kick off with your backstory. So tell us about you and how you got into programming and how you found Django.
I got into programming accidentally by when I was a teenager. We kind of was looking at doing various things on the web, and we kind of learned a bit about it during school. And so I learned HTML and the then nascent CSS stuff that was happening, and accidentally formed a career around that. Managed to get my first job doing that kind of thing. That led to more kind of full stack work where I'd, you know, be involved in the back end and a lot of the front end, back when the front end was much simpler than it is today, you must stress that. And started out doing like PHP back end stuff, and ultimately in around 2010 sat down to try and make something more maintainable when we were working in a web development agency. Obviously, there's a lot of juggling of projects there. We were looking for something that kind of fit the bill and was easier to onboard and revisit later. And we revisited a whole bunch of different frameworks, cross languages, and ultimately settled on Django as having the least cons of all of them. And I've been using it ever since.
Okay, and so in an agency environment, is that your primary where you
were? Yes, yeah, we were an agency for a number of years, and then we pivoted towards doing a specific product later in the time.
Okay, and the key bit for the agency stuff is you've got lots of projects on the go, so you're always cutting and coming back and coming, but they've got to be the same in some sense, because you can't relearn something bespoke for every single project.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of our work was very bespoke. You know, obviously everyone supplements these things with your relatively standard CMS or CRM kind of work, because that's reasonably quick to turn around if it isn't too complex. But you had things like WordPress kind of taking control of those kind of markets, certainly for the CMS stuff anyway. So that meant that we moved more into kind of bespoke aspects, whether that was tailoring a whole back office system or building a REST API on top of some complex job system. We really kind of ended up running the gamut in terms of the range of things we would take on, some more successfully than others, inevitably, but it did become very varied, I would say.
Okay. And so I wanted to ask you then how you got into contributing Django, because you've just very active, and you come in on particular issues and make very insightful comments. And as I look through the issue history, you've been doing that for a long time.
Yeah, I can't remember when my first ticket got opened. It was probably around 2013, 2014 when I actually found something that might be considered an issue. The longer I've worked with it, obviously I've become more familiar with the kinds of things that are likely to be considered bugs and the kinds of things which are likely to be, no, this is actually a problem in user land. I would say that, you know, one of the things is to just keep trying. Fully 50% of my tickets over my career must have been closed as won't fix, because they were some misunderstanding I had or something that had been retread elsewhere in a previous ticket or something. But it's a case of just continuing to kind of try your hand at it. It's not a difficult thing particularly, and the most that really happens is someone closes it as inevitably not relevant. That's the worst that happens. The best that happens is you either get a new feature that you're really after, or you fix a bug that affects you and a bunch of other people. And I think how I ended up starting that contribution process was really just a couple of things I encountered that I thought were errors, and they weren't. they were my errors or they were a third party library's errors. But it begins that process of actually talking with the community about how things progress and whether it's right that they're not in call or are in call. And it's, you know, it's a potluck for me sometimes as to whether it's going to get accepted. And that's always interesting, if nothing else, because you can't have everything in, but much as you'd like to. And there's obviously whole cohorts within the community that have divergent ideas about what should be in there and what shouldn't be in there. And they can become quite polarizing. So straddling that middle ground of what makes the cut is always an interesting thing to try and establish.
Yeah, okay. One thing that you've quite often done, I've seen in recent discussions, which has been, you know, super handy, is, I don't know, we'll be looking at adjusting the settings object or something, and you'll come in with, well, you know, but if you use it in this particular way, which for me, it's sometimes quite a left field way, like, you know, to manually be configuring. So calling settings configure with manual settings, let's put something that, you know, I do, but not very often. And yet you're quite frequently there with, you know, if you configure a script this particular way, it, you know, this happens. So,
yeah, I think that's just a case of having been around the block, so to speak, for so long that I've encountered an awful lot of not uncommon, but less frequent use cases and tried so many various things. You know, there's whole aspects of Django and indeed Python that I'm not as well versed in as I might hope to be. The ORM has come on leaps and bounds over the years, and there's bits of that now that I've never used because of that. But there's also other things where I have used settings.configure to do something outside of a normal management command, and I've had to become aware of the foibles of doing so. And because that's the less common approach, it's more valuable for me to step in those kind of things where it hasn't necessarily been considered because it's off the beaten path. If it's the common 80% use case, then everyone's already going to be thinking of those things anyway. So there's not much I'm going to say that's interesting or poignant towards it.
Yeah, fair enough.
I wanted to ask an open-ended question, which is, so you've been working with Django for coming on 10 years. How has it changed? I mean, just big picture, because a lot of people are new to Django and don't have that history. You know, just what have you seen that you like and dislike in terms of the change in that time?
I would say I came in just after the magic removal branch, which I think was 0.96 to 1, something like that. So I've already missed the boat on probably the biggest change in Django's history. I think some of the kind of bigger ticket items that have really helped the overall community have been things like the bringing into core of a migrations module, which was previously South, and the new migrations module is more flexible and also more robust. And that's certainly not to do disservice of South. We all used it prior to the inbuilt migrations. And the splitting out of like the template backends so that you can use Jinja or Mako or whatever else you'd like to use. I think that was a great step, along with the introduction of app configs. I think by and large those aren't necessarily used as much as people might have expected.
Yeah, not much at all. I mean, certainly for beginners, it's like, because I cover it in my book, and I'm like, you can do all these things, but you know, you won't necessarily, like, I don't see it used a lot at the, you know, more beginner level that I teach.
Yeah, and I think there's some reasons internal to Django that's the case, and some reasons dependent on them being an external library that doesn't get the same focus in the documentation as the built-in Django template language, for example. And of course, Jinja specifically being so similar in look and feel to Django, people don't necessarily know why they might want to reach for that. And the answer to that is usually just a sheer performance one because it compiles bytecode differently and magically, and I don't understand it, but it's cool. But I think the app config one specifically didn't happen in the way anyone foresaw, because there was a long time where the concept of a default app config meant no one had to adapt. And I think the overall adaptation has now happened in Django itself to force that and finally deprecate that. So I think we may now see more dependence on things like an app config that wasn't there before, but that also comes with its own slight tricky intricacies. But those are the big ticket items I can think of in terms of what's actually kind of progressed. And I don't mean incrementally in terms of, like, as I say, the kind of modeling of database stuff that's improved leaps and bounds. You know, the introduction of subquery syntax to actually manually build those was a pretty revolutionary thing, because it allowed a lot more flexibility in what you could do that wasn't magically done behind the scenes for you. But I don't know enough about those, because they keep improving incrementally, and I might be on the last long-term support version. I don't necessarily see, oh, okay, I can use this for that until I get round to the next one. So
yeah,
there's bits I'm less familiar with.
I think the whole expressions API stuff, and it's just phenomenally powerful, and the constraints that have come in. And it's like, there's just all the ORM has become like, oh wow, it's very sophisticated compared to what it is. And it's like, it's kind of hard to learn these things because the docs can be a bit terse.
Yes, I think because it's become more powerful, I think it has also become harder to learn, and that's, I think, true of Python in general. But the more we can focus on what these improvements actually bring to the table, the more the users can get their head around it. But yes, the expressions API is exceptionally powerful, and I probably don't make as much use of it as I'd like to, because I haven't fully thought through how to do it in that way. Because I have that long history of using it, I'm used to doing it a certain way to work around the fact it wasn't there, and now I can do it, but I'm not thinking about it because it's too new, so to speak, in terms of my overall trajectory using it.
Yeah.
Isn't that the curse of learning more?
Absolutely, it is, yeah. It's in many ways, it's easier for a new learner to come on board and get used to the modern way of doing these things, because by the time they are starting it, the incremental journey has already gone so far. But it also means that, yeah, you can end up not out of date necessarily, but stuck in your ways.
There's nothing wrong with being stuck in your ways. That's fine.
Absolutely.
We defend that vigorously on this show.
Well, on the ORM. Oh, sorry, Carlton. You go ahead.
Well, I was just going to segue off. You mentioned the new features of Python. So while we're talking about new features of Django and Chains, what's your sort of take on the way Python's evolved? And
I think it has become a lot more complex, especially over the 3.0 to now release cycle, where there's a lot of additional syntax. There's a lot of additional things that people are looking to add into the code base that makes sense from a maintenance perspective, which is always a great thing to have, but doesn't necessarily make sense in that first kind of almost prototypal phase where you're first building something out. And I'm thinking especially of type annotations. They've become very popular recently through things like MyPy, and there's a couple of others whose names I've forgotten that do type checking. Those add a huge amount of verbiage to the average Python project for the safety of making sure it's doing the right thing. But that's exceptionally difficult to reason about for a new learner. There's also things like the walrus operator turning up, which I've used it more than I thought I would. Which
I got
is
to
a good
use it in Django the other day for the first time.
Yeah,
I was like, wow.
It's great. It's really good. You know, there's use cases for it that I didn't think I'd have. But by the same token, it is the introduction of another type of declaring a variable, and now a new user has to learn that. So I think Python's in a tricky position overall in that it's trying to adapt and become more modern, but it may ultimately be leaving new users in the dust as a result.
I think it was David Beasy had this line that Python fits in your brain. Maybe it's not his line. Maybe it's, you know, just, but it, one of the great things, it fits as the right size for your head and you can hold it all there.
Yeah, it certainly was. I don't know if it still is, especially with the kind of introduction of the whole async IO ecosystem. And I think that's somewhat fractured, which is always going to be a difficult one to deal with. But intrinsically, through the kind of 2.0 to 3.0 release cycle, you could hold it in your head. And that became slightly truer again when 3.3 came around and we had things like Unicode literals again. But it is still expanding. And there may come an inflection point where you've alienated your new audience and you're then left with power users, I suppose we would be, but who know all of that syntax and have internalized all of those things. It's a difficult boundary to straddle.
Well, Django is, I mean, specifically on async, you know, Django is having it basically be like a feature flag where it's there, but it's not a default and you can turn it on and off, which I guess for beginners, it'd be nice if Python had that, but I also see why for maintenance and power users who dominate the discussion, they'd want to just have some of these things in there and not be a separate garden within Python.
Yeah, I think ultimately it would have been nice if we could instantly just flip a switch and become async IO all the way down the line, because that would have made everyone's lives so much easier, from, you know, the Django fellows, the people implementing these things all the way through the pipeline, and the actual users in terms of talking about the deployment strategy. And the deployment strategy for Python has always been a difficult one compared to, say, PHP or Go, where you're just compiling a static binary. And that's always been one of Python's problems, and I think that hasn't changed particularly. It's got better in some ways, it's got worse in some ways. Now we talk about the async IO situation and we talk about red and blue functions and how those affect the overall ecosystem. And ultimately, it is still a transitionary period for Django. I know at some point in the future it will be entirely async IO all the way if you want it. And at some point in the future, it will become that by default. But it's still a process we're going through in terms of getting that adaptation all the way through the whole chain, which is, you know, substantial. It's a full stack framework for the back end, so there's a lot of moving parts and there's a lot of things that can change at runtime, which makes it slightly complicated to even figure out if it is synchronous or asynchronous.
Do you agree with that, Carlton? It's somewhere down the line.
The end point.
That
I don't
was,
know.
That
I
was
mean,
the bit.
Will it? Yeah, maybe. I mean, in principle, why not? Because in principle, it should be slightly less resource intensive to use asynchronous IO. And there's a context switching cost. But, you know, if we can make it async all the way down, then, you know, you should be able to declare a sync view at the top if you want to. I mean, why not asynchronous code? It's because it's more difficult to write and it's more difficult to reason about. So 90% of view code that you write, you should just be using sync Django like you've always been using, because that's going to be the simplest to write, the simplest to maintain, and it's going to be as performant as you need it. Then why do we need an asynchronous story? Well, Django's, you know, full stack web framework. It's there to have all the batteries, and you don't want to change web framework just because you need high throughput for, you know, a particular endpoint, or you want to make some parallel API requests or something. I don't know what, you know, but we need a story there. Do we need to be the fastest web framework in the block? You know, no, we don't. So I don't know. I don't know where it'll end up. I do see, though, that, you know, for instance, we've got an async view dispatch thing in place now, but we still have to kind of wrap the synchronous signals at you know, request started, request finished, those are still synchronous. So we have to wrap those in a sync to async wrapper, and that goes out to a thread. And okay, there's a slight context cost there. Can we get rid of that? Yeah, there's a PR to get rid of that, but there's a performance overhead. It's really complex, and it's like, okay. And it takes a long time to sit down with these PRs and really work through exactly what's going on and exactly why it's slower or exactly why it's quicker or exactly what the error conditions are. And so it's going to take a little while. I'll agree with that bit.
Well, what you're saying about the evolution of Python, is that's pretty interesting to me. I mean, I studied history in college, so I always like to look at past examples. I mean, there is a life cycle to programming languages, and the fact that Python was a teaching language and then kind of got adopted early by Google, and you know, in many ways, right, the data science people made the shift from 2 to 3 happen because the website, that was kind of a mess, but we had all these new people come in. But that does seem a fundamental tension of for a language, right? It's like, who drives the use? It's power users. You have more, I think, background than I do. I'm just trying to think if there's examples of other languages that have gone too far in the power user side and lost people. I mean, I think at PHP has gotten a lot better over time, I would say. But I'm sure there's...
Yeah, I would think I left just before the PHP kind of grew up. I left before it had a package manager and composer. I left before de facto standard frameworks came out in terms of like Laravel and Symfony.
Yeah.
So they kind of revitalized its kind of availability in terms of doing big back-end systems, I would say. PHP always had the benefit of being exceptionally easy to write and easy to run, and it mixed concerns within one file often, but that was fantastic because it allowed people to actually see their results. It grew up with the advent of PHP 5 through 7. It developed all of these extra features, taking them from other languages and other frameworks and other ecosystems. And I think it very much is in a good place now. It's, you know, it's reasonably performant. It's got a great story across any ecosystem niche you might want to fill these days. I would think, in terms of the kind of language familiarity I have, Perl would probably be the one that I would think has sort of entered into the end of its lifetime. And that's not to say it's a bad language, and it's not to say people aren't still using it to do incredible things. It's a great text processing language, but it's one of those things where its time in the sun has waxed and waned, whilst Python is still kind of currently, over the last 10 years, very much in that middle ground. Python has seen a huge increase because of things like the machine learning and all of that kind of stuff that I don't really understand. It's an entire part of the ecosystem that is beyond my understanding, but there's a lot of cool stuff happening with like PyTorch and TensorFlow, and people are using it as a glue language, and that enables the pickup where people don't necessarily have a full understanding of the language. They can still write the things they need to write. I think, you know, in the long term, over the next 10 years, we may find that some of that dissipates because those use cases will be fit by a different language. But we may also find that it just gets codified as Python is the language to do X, Y, or Z because it's been doing it for so long, because it has a decent API for it, what have you. It's still, I think, too early to say that Python is on its way out in any fashion. I wouldn't bet on that particularly, but it's an interesting period, and it's become more interesting over the 3.x release cycle with all the new stuff we've got as a result of that. Time will tell.
You can still write it without all the, you know, the type annotations and things.
You can. You
know, bang out your 30 line Py script that does what you want it to.
Yeah, I find I have a love-hate relationship with type annotations, in that if I'm encountering some gnarly bit of code and it doesn't have them, I really wish I had them. But I also don't necessarily want to write them, because historically, being nominal typing, they've seemed like the wrong kind of fit for what I'd like to do. Python is a duck typing based language, and more recently we've got structural typing in terms of protocols, and I think that that's a great addition, but unfortunately it's still relatively recent, so a lot of the type annotations you see out there will be the old, this is an integer, this is a class of X, Y, or Z, where perhaps they could be more flexible. And I think that's probably part of the reason that Django itself doesn't have type annotations. If you look at the various stub projects for it, they are exquisitely detailed, but exceptionally complex because of that duck typing. That means you can pass anything in that fits a certain structure.
Yeah, but even if you just take the channels project, there was a PR to add type ints onto there. And just taking the example of a user, you know, where a function takes a user object, a Django user object, like the type int was horrific, because it can be an abstract user, an abstract base user, you know, it's just too many types. And so, you know, you might create an alias where you say a user is in fact this horrible thing, but it's like, wow, that really is quite flexible in what's accepted in this function.
Yeah. And I think that's one of Python's strengths, ultimately.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, on PHP, I have a mate who runs an agency. Actually, no, he just joined a company full time, but he's uses Laravel. And so he's always forwarding me things about Laravel. And there's huge advancements there. Sometimes I feel like the people I know in the Django world, we're a little bit myopic in terms of, you know, there's fast API, but non-Python language frameworks. Like Laravel has a lot that's interesting, but the model where it's just one person owns it and runs it so they can just make decisions is sort of this, you know, balancing act. It's sometimes it's nice they can just do it and monetize and they don't have a Django Software Foundation board, but there's less of a community, or it's a different type of community. So that's interesting for me to see. He's constantly sending me all these features that they can do and monetize, and sometimes I'm jealous that they can move faster, but I also think about what, you know, what's the cost? I mean, because it's a one man operation ultimately still, and I wonder how sustainable that can be.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a difference in that community aspect, because absolutely, and obviously, I don't have a huge amount of experience within, you know, the Laravel community. As I said, it came much later, but having that strong personality at the top defining this is what we're going to do, this is what's coming next, is a great thing, and it allows you to push forward your state of the art in terms of what you're producing quite quickly. But you have to balance that with the amount of churn that produces. Django is an exceptionally old framework by modern standards. It's been around like 15, 16 years or something now at this point. So there's a lot of users, and a lot of us are used to doing things in a certain way. Certainly there are things I wish Django had done differently, and or I wish Django would jump in and produce something that hits the 80% case that I see it's missing. But it's more democratic in that it's all just ultimately contributions from the community, putting them into track and the mailing list and talking about those things. And we have the Django enhancement proposals thing to make sure that if something big is coming into core, it's well specced out. And I don't know what Laravel has in terms of that, but you can see that they are moving fast across a lot of different fronts, and it's an interestingly different community in that aspect. And yeah, absolutely, there's parts of that I'm super jealous of because they move fast, but there's also a part of me that's like, thank goodness Django doesn't move fast. Yes, I might wish it had X, Y, or Z functionality, or it had done this differently, but it's a very stable framework overall. The number of times I've had real issues changing things on an upgrade cycle are because of third-party dependencies. Most of the changes internal to Django are, one, they're in the release notes and well covered there, but additionally they are relatively minor because it's got that incremental path and it doesn't really subscribe to semantic versioning, so you just upgrade to the next one. the biggest change is when you go from long-term support to long-term support, and even that's mostly just warnings. So it's I would say I wish there were things Django would do and faster, but I entirely get why it doesn't, and certainly it hasn't stopped me using it over these last 10 years to hopefully great effect.
Okay, the traditional sort of answer there, though, is to do things as a third party package, you know, as an add-on. Do you think there are limitations to that approach?
I think doing it as a third party add-on is often the best case initially. That's certainly how migration started out. That's how static files started out. And there were various community provided Jinja integrations, for example, to cover off the things we talked about earlier. I think the problem with relying so much on third parties is, one, you're then beholden to an even smaller cohort of maintainers, because a lot of these third-party packages...
Just one person.
Won't have. Yeah, there's just one person. Absolutely. So you become dependent on a smaller number of maintainers. You become dependent on a larger divergent set of maintainers who obviously have different priorities, and they have, you know, lives that they want to live independent of their open source contributions. And ultimately, whilst it does sometimes pave the way for things to come into Django proper, it does also mean that Django itself doesn't have an answer for that.
Yeah.
And the biggest, you know, one of the biggest areas now served by Django itself, I would say, is REST APIs, using REST framework. Previously, we had things like TastyPy very early on. There was a couple of others, but REST framework seems to have taken the mind share overall. And that's great, because it means the community works entirely within that ecosystem. But it's still a disappointment that when you come to say to a new user, let's use Django for this, then they ask about that story, how do REST APIs work, what does it have there? The answer is it doesn't have that. It absolutely has the kind of underlying primitives, but it doesn't have the full story, so you have to reach out for that third package, and then you're into that kind of maintenance aspect that I talked about. So as with everything, it's a difficult balancing act, and the notion of increasing what's in core, I think, has been diminishing over time, because core has had some things ejected out of it. I think there's a couple of little packages. Form tools, I think, was one that got made into a separate package because it's not the most common use case. But I think there are some things where Django is missing a story for the 80% in that 80-20% rule that it could be serving. And I don't think there's a good answer to that, because it's a lot of extra burden to take on for a very small kind of core set of people who are working on it day in, day out, and it's a lot of extra burden. But when you evaluate it against saying to people there's nothing built in for that, especially when the web has changed so much over these last 15 years. When Django first came onto the scene, it was revolutionary for the Python community in the same way Rails was for the Ruby community. And I think in some aspects that's less true now. And you see that in the competing frameworks that are kind of capturing mindshare today, like Fast API or Black Sheep or what have you. They
wouldn't heard about Black Sheep.
There's always another one.
Yeah, there's a framework of the week.
Yeah, absolutely. And they are interesting, and they serve a different purpose to what the core of Django now provides. Django now provides a template language, and always has, but that's not even necessarily making up the majority of use cases. It may still be. I don't have any data on it, but certainly there's a lot of REST-driven APIs for a given value of REST, and those aren't going to be using the kind of template language backend anywhere near as much. So it's always a hard thing to balance that. And I don't have to sit in a position where I make the judgment, which is fantastic for me.
I mean, just on the REST framework type side, there's a couple of tickets. One to add to extract the request parsing into a kind of separate class, because we've got the multi-part parser, so you know form data comes in, but to make that kind of pluggable, so you could have a JSON parser in there, and then we could have content negotiation, and then at that point it becomes okay, you could accept JSON requests and form encoded requests, and okay, that starts to look more resty. And then you know the serializer story we don't quite have, but you know there's no reason why that couldn't be brought in. And then you've got 80% of what REST framework gives you with the, you know, the generic views. Yeah. And
that's very much something I've been thinking about recently too, because I think, as you say, half the story is already there and the missing half is difficult to do in a backwards compatible way, but not insurmountable. As you say, the content negotiation, the parsing of the request body, these are all things that we can make work. And once you do, even the Forms API, I think, could probably be adapted successfully. Because one thing people don't necessarily fully understand about the Forms API in terms of internally is it's a reasonably good API for validating a dictionary, which is perfect because most web requests these days are perhaps nested, but they're just dictionaries of here's some data. Now, the Forms API itself doesn't currently allow you to have nested dictionaries, but there's no reason it couldn't. And I've been thinking about how I might tackle that. Because, yeah, I think once you have that and you've got body parsing and you've got content negotiation, you've got like 3/4 of what people actually want. And the Forms API then has enough rich metadata inside of it that you could do stuff like generate an open API schema for the whole thing, and you get, you know, a rolling stone effect. It'll have knock-on effects for everything. REST framework would be able to become lighter, as would Tasty Pie, and so those extra dependencies you do have would have less surface area and more eyes would be on those other bits because they're now in Django proper. So that's, you know, a promising thing.
It's, no, do you have a question, Will? Otherwise, I'm going to swing to performance.
Always, but you go ahead.
But
well,
okay. Well, if you've got a question, cut in, because like
not as good as probably your question. So you go ahead.
Okay. All right. Fine. So, Kez, the other thing I wanted to really talk to you was you've done lots of tickets on optimizing, you know, little bits of Django or on profiling bits on the template engine. You're working on speeding that up. You mentioned that earlier, that Ginger's faster. Well, okay, let's make the DTL faster. Can you talk about, you know, how you go about, how you approach an optimization ticket and, you know, your thoughts there and the process you go? Because I find it really interesting. You open these really detailed tickets that spell out, you know, some real clear gains that then make it easy to review and easy to think, oh yeah, let's get that in.
The process is exceptionally hit or miss. The tickets you see that I'm asking you to consider in terms of merging are the ones that have proved successful. I've been down so many dead ends that it's unreal. I have so many notes just floating around with numbers in that don't prove anything. You'd
right, but that's important to hear as well, though, because if people are thinking,
if you're looking at my tickets that are performance related recently, they probably represent maybe a 25% success rate in terms of things I've actually found. There's pages of notes around, okay, well, can I try and speed this up? Not targeting any specific area, but just a thing that looks like maybe I could speed it up. And the answer is no, because of consideration X, Y, or Z that I hadn't seen elsewhere, or because I'm not super familiar with that bit of the API and the way it's used, and I have to wait 500 seconds for the entire test suite to fail, essentially, and say, no, that was wrong. So by no means is it a 100% success rate. It's mostly a case of finding a section of the code that I think probably could have some speed up applied and seeing if after that speed up is applied, is it even worth it? Because again, even if I make a change and it's 50 nanoseconds faster on my machine, if it's in a piece of the framework that's not a hot loop, essentially, it's a waste of time to really deal with it. If it's called once per process and I'm saving 50 nanoseconds, it's probably not worth actually wasting the time on, because everyone's already got a whole bunch of things to look at and work on. So it's got to be relatively frequently used or a pathological case, and then it has to show actual meaningful value. And deriving that meaningful value is it's difficult, because measuring things is not easy. I won't say I get it right 100% of the time, but if it looks repeatable across multiple runs, if it looks like I can come back and rerun it in 2 days' time and it may not have the same numbers, but it's got the same kind of overall difference, that's when I consider opening a ticket. And so that means a lot of data collection, and it means writing any individual ticket about it takes quite a lot of time, because I need to make sure I'm getting the data right and explaining why that data is relevant. And ultimately, all of that might be to save a couple of microseconds here or there, but it happens a lot. And so that build-up allows it to actually have a real difference in production, so to speak. But it is exceptionally hit and miss. I won't try and paint it as always 100% successful. No, no, no.
I think testing reminds me of, there's the XKCD about compiling code, where, you know, it's like the number one excuse of programmers goofing off and they're fighting with swords and the manager is like, what are you doing? It's like, code's compiling. We don't really have that in Python, but the test suite, you know, if it's...
We do when you're running the test suite.
Yeah, I mean, that's... And, you know, I mean, Adam Johnson, we've had on numerous times. He has a whole book on speeding up your Django tests. But in a larger code base, yeah, if it takes more than 30 seconds, you know, it's like, well, that's a 15-minute break right there just every time. So,
yeah, I try and make sure I do as much work that I think will run successfully before running all of the tests. As I say, I think it takes me about 500 seconds to run them without using the parallel runner. So it's a significant chunk. I'll go and have a coffee and see what I come back to. And if it's good news, maybe there's a ticket. If there's not, then I will hang my head in shame and move on to something else and see if there's another way to do it.
I wanted to ask about Django Technical Errors, which is a new third-party package you have up, which has subjectively better 404 or 500 pages. I was actually going to... I forget where I saw it. Maybe I saw this just looking at you before this interview, but a couple of weeks ago, I wanted to put it in the Django newsletter, and Jeff Trippett was like, oh, it seems kind of alpha, but I wanted to put a note being like, still alpha, but that looks very cool. Like, can you talk about where that's at? Like, can I put it in the newsletter? Are you comfortable with a lot of people looking at it?
I mean, I would say I'm comfortable with people looking at it, but I'm less comfortable with people using it. It's still in that alpha stage of I'm still thinking through all of the ways I'd like to display the information and figuring out all of the different pieces of information that Django's existing error pages display. And the only reason I'm looking at it is because those error pages have stayed substantially the same for most of Django's lifetime, but the web has moved on. We have better understandings of things like accessibility. We've got things like dark mode, people who have preferred reduced motion. All of these things mean that there's probably something to be done in terms of improving the error pages. And the reason I call it subjectively better is because I'm not as well versed in accessibility as I'd like to be. And it's a lot of experimentation that I'm doing there. Hopefully one might be able to say they're objectively better, but I certainly wouldn't make that claim because I don't have a full scope of how it should be and how it actually works for the users. It's currently just me playing around with it. It's in a promising state. It's currently using Tailwind to output all the CSS mostly as an exercise in getting familiar with that, because that's relatively new and I hadn't had a chance to play with that particularly. But ultimately I would be ditching that in favour of actually just embedding all the CSS in the file. It's in progress. It's very much alpha. I think it's cool. I'm kind of enthusiastic for it, but if nothing else, I'd like it to spark a conversation about improving the error messages and all of that surrounding stuff. I don't necessarily think as it is it would ever end up in core, though I, you know, would be thrilled to have that. But if it at least, if when I park it, it has achieved the job of someone better investigating and providing new error messages and new error pages, then that would be a job well done. And I've, in doing it, I've looked at a number of other error pages, whether they are kind of from competing frameworks or what happens if you Google error page or debug page on Google Images, and just seeing what other people display and how they might display it. So there's probably some aspects of it that are cribbed from somewhere else, but I don't know where. And it's just trying to make something in general that bit easier to parse. And I think that was easier for the Django error pages under Django 2 when we didn't have stacking exceptions. Whereas now an exception being displayed can be very long in terms of the individual frames, because zero division error was caused by Unicode error somewhere else. So, yeah, I'm hopeful for it, but we'll see where it goes. I wouldn't recommend people use it yet.
No. It's a brave thing to take on, the error pages, because they're kind of venerable. We had Karen Tracy on a few weeks ago, and her book was written like a decade ago, and they're almost unchanged from yeah, what
absolutely.
She covers in there.
I've tried hard to point out in the readme that it's subjectively better, but the current error pages have stood the test of time exceptionally well. I think, you know, anyone who comes back to Django having 5 years off can still read that same error page. It's not drifted by any substantial amount. It's just improved incrementally over that time, which is fundamentally what Django does.
Yes, that's Django in a nutshell, no?
Yeah, incrementally improved. And I don't think that's a bad place to be.
Fantastic.
Well, I know we're coming up on time. I had one more, but do you have something you want to, Matt?
No. That's
well, I was just going to say, I mean, what you're saying about Python and its evolution, I mean, we, the Django Software Foundation, think a lot about Django and how to make it secure. And I'm the treasurer, so I'm looking at the books and trying to think, how much money do we need? You know, we always talk about expanding things or keeping it small. But, you know, I would say big picture, pulling APIs in at some point to core in some way, that's a no-brainer. I think that will happen. We'll probably need to expand the number of fellows. I mean, we the DSF is lucky that Carlton and Marius are so good and so efficient that it's not an issue right now, but at some point we'll have other fellows. At some point we might want to expand. We could always raise more money if we needed to fund things. So these are kind of the questions from the DSF level we think about. You know, how do we make Django better? But I would say for beginners, anyway, so my wish list, I would say bringing APIs in some form. CMS, I mean, you know, Laravel has APIs and CMS. Wagtail's amazing. It's kind of the default now. I don't know if that needs to be brought in the same way APIs does. But then deployment. Deployment's the deployment, and maybe I should at some point write another official tutorial that kind of gets people kind of what I have in my books, but something that says, here's how to write and launch a Django project for beginners, because that's missing a bit now, partly because deployment is tricky, and also because subjectively, like saying, well, what's the default you can, you know, what are the settings configs, like what's good enough to put live? But I think those three things, if there was more about CMS and the official docs, bring the APIs in, and a way to build and deploy a project from the official docs, I think those would all help, and certainly some of those are doable. But I'm curious what your list is. I put that out there as that's me ruminating publicly.
I mean, the list of things I'd like to see changes on a daily basis, depending on what I'm dealing with, I suppose. But certainly having an answer for building the majority of an API would be one of the top ones. I think it would be nice to have, and it's a risky proposition, but I think it would be nice to have an answer to how to do the front-end ecosystem. There's a number of competing packages in terms of how do I bolt Webpack onto it? How do I make use of Babel or TypeScript? And because the front-end has become such a separate beast than it was previously, and it's got its own ecosystem and its own configuration to deal with, that's still a difficult thing to get your head around if you're not fully deep within it. Now, I think Rails has had more attempts at doing that. I think it has sprockets and the asset pipeline and stuff, and they change things more frequently, as far as I'm aware. And the front-end ecosystem has moved at a very quick pace over these last 5 or 6 years, ultimately. So adding something like that into core would be a risky proposition, because you may end up switching it out two versions later for the current in thing. But perhaps that's settling down with things like ESBuild and SWC that allow you to kind of make use of JavaScript modules or Tailwind packages. So maybe that is becoming something where you can finally add something in and not just risk it needing tearing out in two versions time. I think that would be a good thing to have an answer for. And I think at the moment it's fine that the answer is use this popular third-party package because it's so changeable. But I think one day perhaps when it all settles down and things have stabilized fully, if it ever happens, that would be a cool thing to have.
I've been waiting for JavaScript to settle down.
Yeah, I was going to say, we always have to ask us now about HTMX. Have you used that? Do you have thoughts on that?
I haven't used HTMX. I have used the previous version of Carson's
intercooler.
Yes, I used that on a number of projects, and I think I have a package for that somewhere as well, just to kind of make the Django side of it more useful and more built in. I really liked intercooler, and I think whilst HTMX isn't a big change from what intercooler was, I think it's happening at the right time in terms of he seems to be having much more success finding an audience for HTMX than intercooler, which was always possibly a little too early for its time. It was, you know, competing with Angular and Ember and React as the things that had the zeitgeist at the time, and now I think we're not necessarily seeing a pushback on that, but with things like HTMX and Alpine.js, and then you've got the various live view things that Phoenix has, and I think Laravel's got an equivalent, you're seeing more decoupling again. So where we might have had a full offline first React front end, some people are pushing back into we can do a lot of it on the server and just add in that interactivity we need via this small package. And I think that scales relatively well. Your system has to be very interactive or very complex to not be able to get by, at the very least, with some combination of the two. And I think most people with a middling amount of development experience of something of that ilk would know when to stop doing that and move to a fully separate front end and a fully separate back end, or merge the two completely. And that's always a different inflection point, because it depends on the project, depends on what it's doing. Is it so interactive that it's web sockets and streaming diffs all the way down, or is it just an occasional Ajax update to refresh some chart or other? But I think it's a super cool project, and whilst I've not used it, having used the previous one to do a couple of projects, I'm really enthused by that one.
Yeah, it feels like it's moving up that gap in terms of having to switch over, because like I'm just about to, well, by the time this comes out, my updated APIs, Django APIs book will be out. A lot of newcomers come to me and say, I have to use APIs and React or Vue and just every, you know, bag of tricks. And I always say, well, you incrementally get there. You know, start with just Django, do stuff in the templates, only switch to APIs later unless you're experienced or know you need it. And so HTMX just keeps pushing that out, which certainly for people learning or on smaller projects, if you don't really need it, it's a whole other world to manage. So I think that's good for all of web, but especially for Django. That helps. There's more you can do with just default Django.
Yeah, there's a simplicity to it that's powerful enough to get a lot of stuff done, but also means you are just progressively enhancing.
Yeah, progressive,
things.
That's the word, yeah.
And yeah, I think there's a lot of value in that. And I think it dovetails quite nicely with the way Django works, in that Django has always been about getting something that works and works well. And HTMX and things of that ilk that are small but powerful allow you to do that on the front end as well. And that's certainly not to criticize React or anything, you know. But yeah, I'm a big fan of the kind of progressive enhancement route.
Carlton, you had...
Well, no, I totally agree with all of that. Obviously, I think as well, you talked earlier about extending the Forms API maybe into, you know, a REST-y serializer type domain. And what I find is really nice with HTMX is the ability to push, I'm still using a form. And you get to the, you know, maybe with a sprinkle of Alpine, and instead of sending JSON data, you just send form data. You know, the JavaScript's got the form object. It's like, oh, I'm still using a form. You know, it's like I haven't actually got to the point where I needed JSON at all yet. And then, you know, if we can then just get the forms that one step further out such that they can sensibly interact with JSON, you know, in and out, then actually it's like, oh, wow, the surface area of what we're able to cover with that core traditional Django stuff just grows to cover the 80%. I think it does cover most use cases at that point. Then, yeah, okay, yeah, specialist endpoint, you know, blah, blah, blah. But that's why I'm excited by it. I think it enables me to do really quite straightforward Django for much longer than I've been able to do for years. Like literally, I don't know, half a dozen years of oh no, now you've got to, you know, you've got to jump into this front end world and it's straight to the API. No, I wouldn't. Why would I go straight to the API? It's really changed the phenomenology of building a website in a way that I find very attractive. So yeah, big fan.
I agree entirely. Having been around for long enough that's where I started doing it, and then there's that middle ground of everything becoming an API, and now we're maybe seeing it go back the other way slightly. There was a simplicity to it, and whilst, you know, a lot of users now expect more interactivity and expect all of the extra stuff that the front end can do that it previously couldn't, there is that successful middle ground where, yeah, it's still just a form coming back, and it's just augmented with the validation error of this field, and that validation is correct for their current content language, and it's in the right position, and it hasn't had to be duplicated in the front end. There's a simplicity to that, and it's really nice to see that kind of thing come back. And I think for Django specifically, that's been helped somewhat by the whole Forms API becoming template based, where previously it was all just strings. Being all strings made it difficult to add classes. It made it difficult to add these extra data attributes that Alpine and HTMX want to add onto things. Whereas now, with the Forms API fully within the template system, it's relatively easy to always augment it with this Tailwind class, this Bootstrap class, this HTMX attribute, this Alpine X data. And so it's allowed it to become more seamless than it otherwise would have been. I don't think I'd have enjoyed working on a project that used Alpine or HTMX or Intercooler if I had to manually output all of the things or augment them all in the Python widgets themselves. So I think that's dovetailed quite nicely.
Well, just as there's the Jamstack in JavaScript, maybe we can get the Damstack going, you know, Django and APIs and markup. Because we've...
Yeah, let's get our own cool stuff.
Yeah, maybe. Well, we had here in the U.S. We recently there was the Postal Service put up a site so everyone could get COVID tests. You know, 2 years late, but it was a static site, and they just had I think it was jQuery or something for the forms and connect to a backend, and they put it together quickly, and it worked, and it scaled to 350 million people or whatever. And a lot of people were like, "Wow, that's amazing! You can do that." And it's like, "Yeah, you can do that. Like that's." It doesn't need to be this big beast. They had to like subdomain the U.S. Postal Service website because it's its own thing. But it's like, yeah, you can be simple and scale, and it doesn't need to be, you know, because everything is so much of the web is just a form. And
yes,
anyways,
I think there's a tendency because we're all driven by interesting new things. There's a tendency to add complexity for the sake of either learning it or because it's the thing to do. And yeah, I think sometimes the performance and scalability thing falls by the wayside. You know, Django's not the most not the most performant thing in the world because it's backed by Python. Python's getting faster, so Django will get faster. Cool. That's fantastic. But it's never going to compete with something written in C++ or something. But it doesn't need to, because the actual performance and scalability for a lot of the web is, as you say, just some form over a database or over an external API, and so much of it is data entry in some fashion that as long as you can horizontally scale out reasonably well, your big bottleneck's probably still going to be your database.
Yeah, well, that's why as a last thing, CRUD, the concept of CRUD for beginners new to web development, when I tell them and show them that everything is 99% of the web is CRUD, that's a real aha moment for people. And they realize, Facebook, CRUD, Twitter, CRUD, like every site, it helps kind of piece together and provide a context that newcomers, you don't think about if you're just using the web. And once you get there, it's like, oh, it's not that hard to create these sites because you're doing 90% of it is the same. You're just changing the skin and is a little bit different, but anyways, that's something I enjoy showing people. And it takes sort of 5 or 6, but when they see, oh wow, like it's all kind of the same, it's like, exactly, like that's what I'm trying to get you to. It's not overwhelming. Like there are these niches and deep areas, but it's kind of the same thing over and over again. But until you build it, you don't think about it.
No, and that's pretty fundamental to the web itself. You know, if you exclude things like WebSockets and all of that, the web's verbs are just other words for CRUD. Possibly they're better words than CRUD because they don't form a bad-sounding acronym, but the acronym is at least catchy that once you hear it, you understand what it means.
Fair enough. Right, let's call it a time. So we've hit up on our hour. So, Kez, thank you for coming on, and thank you for all that you do for Django. It's, you're silent hero, but,
thank
your contribution is really important.
Anyway, you call me a silent hero. You're the silent hero. You do all of it.
Yeah, no.
Don't think I don't see it.
No, it's Marius. It's Marius. Right. Anyway, right. That was Django Chat. Thanks for joining us, folks. Join us again next time. We're djangochat.com and chatdjango on Twitter. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.